Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
The introduction that can only mean it is time for Movies and Booze. And I'm delighted to say we're joined in studio by Michelle Lawler, Fleta Jones, and Chris Walls. You're all very welcome.
Hi.
Can I just say we had the most interesting conversation during the ad break. It was just, I couldn't believe it. Firstly, Fionnuala.
I interviewed Meryl Streep and Stanley Tucci last week.
Yeah. My God.
Crazy.
Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
She's just beyond legend.
Beyond, yeah. And as beautiful in person as you could imagine.
Back in the old days, they used to say that Gay Byrne, of all the people he interviewed, she was the only one that he was beguiled by.
Really?
You could see he was just like a fanboy around her. He wasn't really the normal Gay Byrne.
Yeah, like she's not real. She's just not real. She won 3 Oscars. That's crazy.
It is.
And I talked to her. That's crazy. She was really nice. Really, really nice. Yeah.
Very. And you're not even mentioning the fact that Stanley Tucci.
Sorry, Stanley Tucci as well. Incredibly sharply dressed. Maintained very good eye contact, I thought was interesting, and just seemed like up for a bit of crack. I would have liked to have stayed out with him, but that was not allowed. So.
Did they use your name?
I don't think they did. No, unfortunately, couldn't get them to get their mouths around the vowels. But you know what?
Felt like you were just suddenly.
I know. Transcended.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Next time.
Materialized in the real world, if they said your name.
Yeah.
That's amazing. God. And then, Michelle, you were saying that time when I lived in China.
Oh, yeah. We were talking, I had noodles from the ramen bar on my way up, and I live in Nace, which isn't that far away, but I so infrequently get to the city that when I come in, I'm like, where am I going to have, I plan my lunch down to a tea. And I was just saying that when you're in China, you shake on MSG like you'd shake on salt.
That's hard to believe.
I know, it's real shocking. I was like, what's that weird like peachy stuff? Oh, that's MSG.
Is that really bad for you, by the way?
Is it? I feel like there's some kind of note that it's like been demonised for other reasons.
I'm not an expert.
Neither am I, so
bow out gracefully.
Let's both bow out. Okay, jury's out.
The number of times I hear that when I'm presenting this show, I'm not an expert.
Expert on mine.
Yes. Chris, no pressure on you to come up with a fantastic story. What films are you going to tell us about today?
We're going to look at the Meryl film, The Devil Wears Prada 2. 20 years in the making. And it's like, we'll get into it in a bit, but it's fan service territory, really. I mean, people, like, so many times I sit here and tell you about these long-awaited legacy sequels that nobody asked for. People did ask for this sequel, and there's been a book, you know, it's loosely inspired by a follow-up novel. The follow-up novel is a novel that the first film was based on. So we'll be looking at that, and we will also be looking at Hogan, which is an Irish horror from a chap named Damien McCarthy. And this is Damien McCarthy's third film. He makes films that are genuinely scary, unlike a few other Irish horror films. Filmmakers. We'll get into that. But he somehow roped Adam Severance Scott into being the leading man here. It's a film about a cynical US author who travels to Ireland to scatter his parents' ashes and stays in a hotel that everyone tells him is haunted. He doesn't believe it. Is the hotel haunted? Of course it is.
That is the oldest setup in the history of scary movies. It's a haunted house or something scary that everyone says you shouldn't go into. Mm-hmm. And of course you do.
Yeah, he's going to regret it.
And what's the Irish connection with it?
Damien McCarthy is an Irish filmmaker who made it. And so he shot the film in Cork. But there is a trend. I mean, I have my favourites when it comes to Irish horror filmmakers, which again we'll get into. But there is a trend of Irish horror filmmakers making one big hit and it catching on. So for their second or third one, they get some real big international names.
Sure.
So yeah, Damien is the latest.
That's great. Just before we go on to what we're drinking today, I can't fill you in on monosodium glutamate, MSG, generally considered to be safe by health authorities like the FDA, but it does cause temporary mild symptoms like headaches, flushing, sweating or numbness in a small percentage of sensitive people. While historically linked to Chinese restaurant syndrome, modern studies have largely debunked severe health risks, finding it relatively harmless in a moderate
amount. And is that from Wikipedia?
I'd say probably. Yes. Or it's grown up.
Grand.
So I'll take that to the bank.
Okay.
What lovely things we'll be drinking today.
We have two really exciting wines to try. The first one we're going to try, sorry, the second one, I'm going to start backwards, is a Super Tuscan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Super Tuscans.
Is Stanley Tucci is Super Tuscan, or has he just got strong connections with Italy?
Or is he just gorgeous? We didn't get into that. We talked about how much he liked our butter, but didn't get into the Italian connections that he has. I don't know if he's enthusiastic or has the blood.
Oh, well, he loves this.
Right. So
yeah.
Super Tuscans, they're amazing.
And what I have that we're not, they are, except for the one that I have, but I did bring in, because it arrived, on pure coincidence today, I got a box with 6 bottles of the baby Sassicaia, which I'm not opening because it's so rare, but I thought I'd bring it in just to talk, because it's also a Super Tuscan.
Right.
And then for the white, we're going to try a beautiful Albarino, which is the same as Albarino, but it is from the stable of Sograp, who own Matuus Rosé. And they are an incredible company. And so all will be revealed. Unless you'd like me to reveal immediately.
But when you said the Super Tuscan a second ago and the box you got, a box of 6, then why was that one so rare?
So I forgot that I ordered them, and I was offered by the importer, look, I've only got one box of the, it's called Guido Alberto, and I've one box of the Le Defesi. Would you like them? And I was like, oh God, yeah, absolutely. And I said, any chance of 2 more boxes? And she's like, no, that's the end of it. And that's 2023. So they're sold on allocation. You actually can't get them. But they are... A lot of times, if you think about like a Bordeaux, like a Grand Vin, and you're like, oh, look, I don't want to spend €250 on a bottle of wine, but I like to know what it tastes like. These are second and third wines, so it's an affordable way to taste the greatness.
€250 on a bottle of wine.
God, that the Sassicaia is way over that.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, you love the wines
that
we have.
Look forward to it. We're talking of Devil Wears Prada, and it seems to me that anything that's ever been made just has to be remade. It's the age we live in. There's too many people like Amazon and Netflix, and it's just, you know, they're just all searching for content. And Blair Witch is the latest one, isn't it?
Blair Witch is the latest, yes. Now, why this is significant is this was announced back in 2024 that Lionsgate and Blumhouse were working on a new version of this. And at the time then, after this kind of initial presentation, we had Joshua Leonard, who starred in the original 1999 film, came out and basically said, why are we not involved in this? Why are the original team not involved with this? Like, this is really annoying, especially when, you know, they are so crucial, I suppose, to the original film's success. The latest update now is that they are going to be involved. They're coming on as executive producers, Joshua Leonard and Michael C. Williams, and they're bringing back the first movie's directing team of Eduardo Sanchez, Daniel Myrick and Greg Hale. So does that spell good news for this new film? I'm not really sure, because they have actually tried to do Blair Witch before again. They did Book of Shadows in 2000, which is barely a Blair Witch sequel. If you've watched it, watch for the podcast. It's so bad. Don't watch it. Don't do it to yourself. They also did one in 2016, which was a bit like, you know, shinier. Fine, like whatever. Can't remember anything about it, so actually can't have been that good. Also to watch that for the podcast. I don't really know why they're doing this, other than obviously you said, you know, remakes are a big game
for a new audience.
Yeah, but then you're also bringing back the old audience because they know Blair Witch Project. But like, what made that so good? Like, it was made for $35,000. That was before marketing, but like, it was made for nothing and went on to make, honestly, $248 million, I think, at the global box office, which
is... Do you remember it?
Of course, yeah.
And I had to watch that one for the podcast, and I was like, I can completely understand why this absolutely hit. It still hits now.
Yeah.
It's genuinely freaky. Yeah. They're doing so much with so little. I don't know how you capture that again.
It was kind of stealth marketing, wasn't it? We probably didn't call it that then.
But that's the perfect way of putting it. They did do so much with so little. And the Blair Witch Project, it wasn't just a famous horror because it's an effective horror on screen. It was everything around it. The way it was marketed, the way it was one of the first films to utilize like this online campaign that a lot of audiences around the world, because they weren't internet savvy yet, thought this thing must be real. If this thing is telling us that this is a documentary about 3 people that went missing in the woods, we're going to believe that. It's hard to believe now that people would believe it, but everything about it was just so effective. You can't repeat that at all.
That was a once off. You'll get people this innocent and this not media savvy. You'll never get this again.
You'll never be able to do that again.
I don't know if we quite believed it. But when we heard of it first, it was like, did you hear about this film? These people. And they disappeared in the woods.
Yeah.
And we kind of believed all that.
It felt quite authentic. Whereas, I'm sure the remake.
Genuinely chilling as well. I don't know, my friends and I in school, we believed it at first. I mean, eventually someone older came along and said, you idiots. But, you know, but at first we were totally taken in by it.
Well, we will watch it, won't we? I mean,
we will, but like...
Are they just going to reproduce what we had before, or just maybe make it look a bit better? Or
But then that's not, like, I don't want to see them, oh, we're on TikTok live and I'm on TikTok shop and there's a ghost by me, you know what I mean? Like, I just don't, I'm not into that. Like, we could do something original. We could do something like Hokum or something, I don't know. As you, and look, that's well-trodden turf as well, but I don't know. It was the whole, like, you know, the cameras are fuzzy as well. Like, you don't really know what you're picking up with the technology.
They're really cut off.
Yeah, exactly. Like, who's cut off in this day and age? You know what I mean?
Never.
Like, it's just... I don't
if
know.
You were off social media for more than 2 minutes, people would be looking for you.
Yeah, search party. Maybe that's it. An influencer goes missing. Like.
Yeah, Mary hasn't tweeted in 4 minutes. I'm worried. So on to Andy Serkis. He's Serkis.
Speaking of more remakes, yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
The great question again is why?
Why? Well, look, I mean,
Lord of the Rings, by the way.
You could argue this is a new story within a built franchise as opposed to maybe telling the same story again, although not up on the Lord of the Rings lore. I believe this is set between some of the different films. The film that I'm talking about is Lord of the Rings, The Hunt for Gollum, which Andy Serkis is directing and obviously starring in as Gollum. He's basically talked about, oh, he wants to do this because there's more to Gollum than meets the eye or some. I'm paraphrasing, but he did say there's more to explore in terms of that character. But Viggo Mortensen is not coming back as Aragorn, and people are a bit like, okay, they've recast as Jamie Dornan, and there kind of hasn't been any word on it, but Andy Serkis is obviously on the promo trail to be like, he was on Happy Sad Confused, the podcast this week, and he said, quote, I really, really don't want to go into it right now because I do want to save that for, you know, further down the line. I'm going to save all discussion about casting. Other than that, we are thrilled Jamie's doing it. I mean, we know we're absolutely thrilled. And by the way, so is Viggo. But I'm just kind of like, I'm like, was it money? Was it like, that's where I'm like.
It's hard to see because the rest of the cast seem to be there, don't they?
Yeah, well, the rest of them I don't think are confirmed. But like when they're not confirmed, it's kind of like, well, then you are confirmed. Like you're coming back. Like I think, what's Frodo's name? It's escaping me now. Actor.
Elijah Wood,
I think is like very heavily rumoured to be appearing in some capacity. I mean, I'm just curious.
Ian McKellen,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And look, the thing with Jamie Dornan is he does, like, they got an actor who is the spit off him, but I think Viggo is so, like, he is Aragorn, like, he's so inseparable in a way that I'm just kind of like, would you not have like written him out or something? I don't know, or been like,
Jamie
he's on
Dornan's
holiday
very
or something.
Cool as well.
Yeah, but I mean, everyone quotes the, and again, you know this if you're a Lord of the Rings fan, but like that scene where he kicks the helmet and he actually like broke his toe doing it. So like the scream you hear him screaming is 100% authentic. I'm like, can Jamie do that? I don't know. Are they going to make him kick helmets? I don't know, but we'll see.
Right.
We'll see. We have a while to wait for this anyway, but I just thought it was interesting. I just think for someone to explicitly go, I don't want to talk about it right now, but we'll talk about it later. I'm like, that's an interesting party line. I don't really know why.
But are people just masters of publicity these days? They just...
True, yeah.
Churn it up everywhere they go.
And again, doesn't matter because this is going to make a bajillion euro at the box office.
Yes,
because people want to see what Gollum's up to now.
I think we might have because there's a huge amount of money that I can't stop thinking about it. So I feel we need to do this now and then we can concentrate on wine and movies again after that.
Hi. We weren't properly introduced yesterday. I'm Andy Sachs.
Charlie. I'm the second assistant.
Hi, Charlie.
Hey. Everybody just calls me Charlie with a chair if you want because Amari won't let me leave my desk. Oh, no, it's okay. A million girls would kill for this job.
Heard that. Is Miranda?
There you are.
There you are. I am on time.
So you're the kind of person who thinks on time is on time. Okay, got it. All right, come on. I'll show you to your office.
Amari, I need to pee. Please, I had a venti.
Oh. Was it worth it?
No.
Actually, I should probably talk to Miranda first.
Oh, I'll take you to your office.
Good luck, Charlie.
Thanks.
Well, there was a lot in that, James, you have to say, Chris, a lot in that.
Yeah, was there?
Well, the million line is quoted. For a start, that's thrown in there. You know, they always go back to those tropes, don't they?
Sure, yeah, they do, yeah. It's like, as I said at the top, like it's fan service, this film. People really did ask for it. It's sort of like a greatest hits. This thing wouldn't have worked if, you know, they didn't get the whole band back together. But when it was announced that Stanley and Meryl and Emily and they'd all be back together, I think everyone around just went, okay, fair enough. I mean, because there is such a low for that first film. I never really got it fully. Like, the first film is absolutely fine. It gets some great performances, particularly from Emily Blunt and from Meryl Streep. But with the first film, I always thought, you want to make this satire, this biting satire about the fashion industry, but you also, it's like someone giving out about a party, but they really want to be at the party as well.
Sure.
So it tried to have it both ways, and that used to bother me a little bit. This one, it spends the first maybe like 20 minutes, possibly even the first half an hour, trying trying to just settle, because it has that problem that every other Legacy sequel has, where the first film finished, it felt like the story came to a natural conclusion and all the characters went off and had their future. And we don't know what that future is, but we all have our own idea of it. To then force everyone back into the room and say, do the same thing again, that's quite a difficult thing to do. So you can see, you can practically see, you know, the wires trying to get everyone back into place in the second half. So it's 20 years since Anne Hathaway's character, Andy Sachs, was running around New York putting out fashion flyers for her boss, runway editor in chief, Miranda Priestly, played by Meryl Streep. And we know at the end of the first film that she went off to have a successful journalism career. And she seems to have had that. The only problem is, just as she's accepting an award for, you know, her career, she also receives a text to say that she has been fired. So Andy is in the same position that she was at the beginning of the first film. She needs a job. Now, because she is a credible journalist and Runway magazine, that's Miranda's magazine, they're at a place where, you know, they're no longer credible. They're losing their audience. It's mostly digital. They're in the midst of an awful PR crisis. They need to gain back some credibility, so they decide to hire Andy as a features editor. Now, there is a fabulous bit at the beginning where Miranda claims not to remember Andy, and that is very good.
Yeah.
But it's Miranda's right-hand man, Nigel, is delighted to see Andy back. Where's Emily Blunt? Well, she's off working at Dior, but the film will find a way so that the four, you know, band members get back into the room again and conspire, and I hope I'm getting this right, to basically save the company, save the magazine from a couple of finance bros. That's pretty much it.
Right.
I mean, the film does spend an awful lot of time after it gets everyone back together looking for a plot. I mean, this thing is 2 hours long, but there's barely enough story to go around. There are a few supporting characters, though. There's Kenneth Branagh playing Miranda's love interest. There's Patrick Bramall, an Australian actor, playing Andy's love interest. Neither of those guys really register at all. I don't know why Kenneth Branagh is in this thing. And I was going to maybe give out about that, but then I realised that those two guys are basically playing what every female actress used to play in a film populated by men in the 80s and 90s, where they would just exist for the spouse. They would get 10 lines, and it would always be about the spouse.
Yeah.
So to then start complaining that, you know, Hollywood is doing that to men, well, you know, it's our time. It's our time.
Yeah.
So is the film any good? It's kind of a whole lot of nothing, but it's pleasant enough.
But you didn't really like Devil Wears Prada 1, did you?
No, I mean, I thought it was absolutely fine. And I think, and you know, I kind of forgot it existed after the first time I watched it. No, you know, nobody else did.
A lot of people liked it. Did you like it, Michelle?
That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And a lot has happened since then, so I can't remember much. I think I possibly enjoyed it.
That's the MSG, by the way.
Yeah.
I didn't want to say that to you, but anyway, you've seen it
love
as well, haven't you?
Yeah,
you
I watched it again recently, and I just think it's so much funnier than I remember. Because obviously, it's been like mythologized so much as well, and like social media and popular culture, like Miranda Priestly is now this iconic character that is just memeable and quotable to all end. But like everyone else is putting in a very good performance now. A product of its time, like some of it like doesn't really fly as a lot of stuff doesn't from the noughties, but I was very pleasantly surprised by it on rewatch.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. I love the cast are all amazing.
Yeah, and that's
the people I'd watch all day long,
and they're the people carrying this film. I mean, if Devil Wears Prada was a film of its time, this one tries to maybe keep up with the time, so that's where some of the creaks are. But it does feel, again, to use the analogy, it feels like a band coming back together again, and they're like, here's the greatest hit set, we've relearned everything, is this okay? And you're kind of sitting there going, you know what, not everything has to blow our minds.
Yeah.
This is actually okay. But I thought Anne Hathaway was okay. Stanley Tucci seems to be enjoying himself. It's Blunt and Streep who steal the show here, because Emily Blunt's character is allowed to still be wicked. She still has these acidic put-downs that, you know, deserve to be framed and put up on a wall somewhere. Whereas Meryl Streep, she's softer. It is a softer film. But when she's allowed to be wicked, because her character is basically constrained by, you know, political correctness and contemporary revisions in the workplace, so she's not allowed to be, you know, the devil anymore. But when, you know, her little minions look away and she comes out with something that, you know, you wouldn't repeat, it's fabulous. It is actually genuinely funny. So their energy, you know, and their charisma, and, you know, also the chemistry between the four of them, that really worked for me. It just does feel, though, like, and also it is a nice looking film. I know we talked a lot before about how when the trailers were released for this thing, everyone thought, oh, there's like a flattened Netflix sheen off of this on the big screen. There wasn't. By the time it gets to Disney Plus, I don't know what it's going to look like. But it's a pleasant enough time. Like, it's not amazing. Yeah. I don't think anyone was expecting
it. It kind of reminded me of Spinal Tap 2, which I saw. Now, I loved Spinal Tap 1.
Which was nice, yeah.
I enjoyed Spinal Tap 2. I had no problem with it.
No.
I was delighted to see the characters back on the screen. Yeah. I thought the cameos were great. You know, was it a patch on the original? No, it wasn't. But I still, I felt there was a place in the world for it.
Okay.
I'd say Prada people are going to say the same about this.
There are worse ways you could pass the time tonight if you go see it.
I know you have fantastic behind the scenes stuff on this, but we actually really badly need to have the glass of wine. Which we were supposed to have about 5 minutes ago. My apologies.
That's okay.
So I just got excited during the cash call.
That's okay. Thing. We're going to start with the white if you want to have a little sip of this delicious glass
going white
of white
first.
Wine. We're going to go white first. Yes. The red has a lot of oak in it. So if we were to try the red first, that power in the red would mask all the nuances in the white. So oftentimes if you do wine tasting, you go lightest to more powerful so that you don't miss the nuances. So what we have in front of us is this gorgeous wine from Portugal, about an hour north of Porto, called Quinta de Azevedo. And it's Alvarinho. And Alvarinho is the same grape as Albarinho. Have you tried it?
Really?
It is soft and lush, peachy, apricot fruits. What's happened, because Albarinho is so popular, you've all heard of Albarinho, have you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay. Because Albarinho has become so popular in the last decade, but where you grow Albarinho in Spain, so it's just north of the Portuguese border, is so small and it's a delimited area, so you can't do more of it, that the demand to grow grapes there is so high, the price of Albarinho from Spain has gone through the roof. And we've seen wines that we would have paid, or we would sell for like 15 or 16 euro, go up to like 21, 22 euro. And it's literally supply and demand. It's not a reflection of quality. So what's happened in the last number of years, and I would only say only 4 or 5, like it's quite a short trend or a short period of time, is a surge in Alvarinho, which is the Portuguese for Albarinho.
Yeah.
And primarily it's in Vinho Verde, but you get these beautiful single varietal expressions. And so if you're familiar with Albarinho, you probably recognize a lot of those flavors, which are peaches and apricots and lemon. What I love about this one, and when I say it, people might go, is that it's made in some old oak. And a lot of people, when they hear the word oak, they want to run really fast in the other direction. I know. This might turn them into this, because it adds in like a vanilla, creamy flavour, which a lot of people really just want the citrus fruits. Mm. But what it adds to this is broader mouthfeel. And what I find with this one, and I know it's a little bit warm, the studio is quite hot, and I walked across town with this wine. But it's got this really kind of generous texture in the mouth. It just kind of coats it and sits there, and it's just really lovely. But what's really cool about this particular winery, there's two things. Quinta de Azevedo would have been an old castle outpost for the Portuguese, I don't know if monarch is the right word, like hundreds of years ago, where they kind of were to stop the Spanish from getting closer to the city and the port of Porto. And the family who owned this, which is Sograp Company, bought up this really old castle and refurbished the whole thing over a 2-year project in the 80s. And so it's just this really gorgeous property producing a beautiful wine. But it's produced by Matuas Rosé, effectively. And Matuas Rosé, most people are going, I can't believe you're allowed to mention that on the radio, because of the dark, sweet pink rosé that you would have bought in a petrol station. But the company, Sograp, is one of the most amazing companies in all of Portugal. I think the largest family-owned business in Portugal. And what they have done over the years, they started during World War II, is buy up these properties with the view of preserving the Portuguese wine-producing heritage. And so they make Matuas Rosé, kind of like their blockbuster film. And then they have all these beautiful projects, kind of like the art house things.
Right, very good.
And what's amazing, they actually have, I was over there recently, they actually have contracts with 21,000 growers in Portugal. So they're they're the biggest producer, but they're still family owned, and they have made it like a lifetime project and a legacy project for the future to preserve the grapes. It's all about indigenous grapes. We're going to be trying in the red French grapes done in Italy, whereas we're trying what Portugal does best from Portugal. And so it's a really cool project. I think the wine is fabulous. For me, it's one of the best examples, price point, of Albarinho that you can get on the market. Just a really lovely wine. And it's just bliss on this sunny day.
I thought it was gorgeous.
Thank you.
Very beautiful. And vanilla.
Really nice. Yeah, really, really
delicious.
Nice.
Yeah.
And thumbs up all round.
Yeah.
None of us are mentioning vanilla or cherry or anything. Yeah.
But what happens when you put a wine in old oak barrels? It doesn't add a vanilla flavour, but it adds a texture and a structure to the wine that makes it better to pair with food. Because a lot of times if you've had, like, say, you know, a bad Chilean Chardonnay in a quarter bottle in a pub, and I'm sure everyone can feel how that pain really is.
So
it's not that, it's the exact opposite. This is about making something a bit more gastronomic.
Beautiful. Well, absolute thumbs up from us. It was beautiful. Thank you very much indeed. We're going to get some great, I won't call it gossip, but information on Devilwears Prada. Before that, just talking about how the difference in perception on things, and we were talking about Michael and how, I haven't met a critic who liked it, but it's...
You know, I will say I haven't seen it, but I have no interest in seeing it.
Yeah, never mind. It's gangbusters, you know, at the box office. And then on the Blair Witch Project we had, I made the mistake of going to see the Blair Witch Project. It was rubbish. I don't care how much it earned. It was overhyped. At the end, I wanted a refund and those 90 minutes of my life back. And then immediately afterwards, we were on a J1 in the States and went to the Blair Witch on the opening night. The scariest cycle home I've ever had.
Just give me the heebie-jeebies even thinking about it.
Very different tastes around the world, isn't there?
Yeah.
So listen, the lowdown on The Devil Wears Prada 2, Meryl Streep just went in there and decided she would just demand whatever she wanted.
Essentially, yeah, she went in and got double her salary because she knew that they would not do the film without her, essentially. And she said, I'm kind of old enough at this stage. And she's saying that she thought at this stage she was going to retire. She's 76. She was doing an interview there where she was talking about it, where she said, quote, I knew it was going to be a hit. I read the script. The script was great. They called me up and they made an offer. And I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And then basically said she wanted to see if they would double, if she would just went back and was like, I want double. And they just went, sure. Because I think they also knew, not being funny, like, obviously it's Dave Frankel is the same director and like Anne Hathaway's back, Emily Blunt's back. There's no film without Miranda Priestley. No, you know what I mean? So now she's talking about again, she's like, I was okay because I'm old. These are her words, by the way. Because I'm old, I'm 76. I was ready to retire, which I'm like, I don't know how much I believe that, but
yeah,
we'll
not
see.
At all.
Remains to be seen.
The bit of her, you think, at times you think she's just getting going.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And then I didn't realise that Devil Wears Prada was based on a book, and that is by a real person.
Yes, it is by a real person. Lauren Weisberger, I think, wrote the first book, and it's based on her experiences of working in Vogue. It came out in 2003. And
she was the Emily Blunt character?
She's the Andy Sachs character, yeah. She worked in Vogue for 8 months, and basically, with this film, it's really interesting. Like, the first film, Vogue and Anna Wintour, because obviously Miranda Priestley is supposed to be based on Anna Wintour as well, formerly editor-in-chief of Vogue. She has some other kind of, to be honest, made-up title now, but she's still involved in Vogue. They kind of didn't really associate themselves with the first film. Now, she turned up in the premiere in Prada, so like, interpret that how you will. But this time around, it's like, she's on the cover with Meryl Streep. The book was the Vogue Book Club for April. And with this as well, they have a podcast called The Run Through, and they spoke to celebrity stylist Leslie Framer, who claims that she is the inspiration behind the Emily character.
Right.
So to Lauren Weisberger as Andy Sachs, like, they were kind of the adversaries in real life. She said she'd kind of gotten a heads up from, she hasn't spoken to Lauren since, and I don't think knew about that Lauren was kind of doing the book until it happened, and said basically, like, Anna Wintour rang her and said, quote, who's Lauren Weisberger? And I said, she was your junior assistant. And she's like, well, she wrote a book about us and you're worse than me. And then Framer, she was like, I wanted to ask her more questions, but like, you don't really ask Anna Wintour more questions. But I thought this was the most interesting. She said there's lots of other tidbits where she's saying, where we heard in the clip there where, you know, a million girls would kill for this job. She's like, I definitely said that because I believed it at the time, like 100%. But she said ultimately the book felt like a betrayal. Obviously, as I said, she hasn't spoken to Lauren since. But she said she had the opportunity to speak to Emily Blunt since. I'm not sure where this is in the timeline, but she got to speak to her to be like, oh, basically, like, I'm the real Emily. And she said, quote, she was not that interested, to be honest. I thought I was going to get this like huge reaction. Like, it was like, oh, okay. Like, Emily Blunt is like, I do not care. Get out of my sight. I'm Emily. I don't know who you are, girl.
Yeah, like, I really don't care. Yeah.
Like, it's just poor thing. Oh, anyway, amazing. She's on that podcast if you want to listen to it. But yeah.
So I find it amazing that the book came out. The book's been in the making and has done so much for Anna Wintour as well.
Yeah, exactly. And like, when you look at this fit, like, I did another piece recently this week on like the commercial partnerships involved in this film. Like, it's Barbie levels of, we are partnering with Dyke fuck, we're partnering with Starbucks, we're partnering with Tresemme, we're partnering with Tweezerman. Do you want a Devil Wears Prada tweezers? You can get one. Like, it is wall to wall. So it's kind of like, again, doesn't really matter what the critical consensus is. There is such a love for the original film, love for the cast. And then also it's just so culturally ubiquitous, I think, yeah, that it's unavoidable wherever you're trying to go.
You've no wine placements going on in this, Michelle? You missed
no,
that?
No, but Meghan Markle, totally unrelated, used to have a blog called The Tig, which is a super Tuscan. But that would probably make you not want to read
it. Oh, I didn't know that. That's why it's called The Tig.
Yeah, because it's after an Italian super Tuscan called Tignanello.
There you
which
go.
I don't
did
have here.
That.
That's wow. really expensive.
Okay. You have to say how the worlds have changed over the 20 years from when, you know, the magazines and that world led everything. And now the magazines are almost non-existent. And,
yeah.
And the fashion trends are more likely to be set on social media than on a runway.
Yeah, I think the film explores that actually really well because they go from being this, Runway goes from being this respected publication to something where, you know, the team sit around the table and think of the most clickbaity thing that they can put up just to get figures up. And even when Anne Hathaway has writers go out and do, you know, Andy Sachs has writers go out and do really clever in-depth interviews, they're just not getting any hits. So as a journalist, I was sitting there watching it going, this is terrifying. That's scarier than any horror film I've watched this year because this is real.
Yeah.
So it does actually explore that very well.
Look forward to seeing it. I have to be honest, I think they're actors that I just would be happy to watch.
Yeah.
It keeps reminding me of Murderers in the Building, where at this point I think they've absolutely flogged it to death.
They have.
But you're still watching
it.
It does need to end. Yeah.
I love those guys so much.
Me too.
But yeah. I need to see the back of them.
I think we could write this at this stage.
Yeah.
You know, just keep those people on screen. That's all they seem to want to care about anymore. Well, I'm dying to read about Val Kilmer, but I think we might, a bit of me says we should probably have our break out of the way. So we've loads of time for our next film. And our Super Tuscany on the way. You're very welcome back. I think we're going to have our second movie now, so we're going to have our clip from Hokum.
First time in Ireland.
My folks came here for their honeymoon. Always wanted to come back.
Why didn't they?
I don't know if you've noticed, but there are some oddballs walking around this place.
There are worse things than strangers out there, Yank.
One of the members of staff is missing.
What about the honeymoon suite?
It's always locked.
I'm getting a weird feeling. Something feels off.
Well, it sounds very scary, Chris, although I have to say I'm finding the Irish voices a bit, I don't know what they're reminding me of. Finland. Don't be going into that room now, sir.
It's stagey.
I'm telling you now.
Yeah.
Whatever you do now, you're not going into that room, right? Just leave it out. Warn you.
It does sound a little bit like that. It is a bit more settled in the film, trust me. I like this guy, Damien McCarthy. The last film that he had a couple of years ago was Oddity. If you haven't seen it, check it out. Very good. About a guy who loses his wife and then visits her blind sister at her oddity shop and gets himself all caught up in haunted house, haunted oddity sort of situation.
It is
With a fantastic ending. McCarthy doesn't just make scary films, he makes scary films with brilliant endings.
Yeah, that's one of the hardest things
it
to pull
is,
off.
Yeah, a good horror ending is so difficult to pull
so
off.
So often they're so bad.
Oh yeah, because even like
to the reveal and you're going, did I really watch an hour and a half of this?
Oh yeah, even the master of horror, Stephen King, terrible endings. There isn't a single Stephen King story that ends well, which probably explains why every Stephen King adaptation you have watched, from Carrie to The Shawshank Redemption beyond, all those endings were made up by the filmmakers.
Wow.
Everything. They are very difficult to pull off, but I think he does it well here. This story tells of a very cynical author named Owen Bauman, played as you could hear by Adam Severance Scott, who arrives in Ireland to finish his latest masterpiece. He's a writer of very famous fantasy novels, and he's completing this trilogy, and he's a bit stuck on the ending, as it were. And he also has arrived in Ireland to spread or to scatter his parents' ashes. His parents honeymooned here. We're in rural Ireland, I think we're in the West, and he's never been here before. What's he like? He's not a great dude. He's a bit of a jerk, quite selfish, cantankerous, rude to all the locals, and he's in a part of the world where everyone says hello to each other and everyone knows one another's business, so he doesn't like that. But when he checks into his hotel, he meets some characters who start, you know, spreading ghost stories. Peter Cooner runs the hotel. He meets a couple of people at the bar. And they all start talking about how you there's certain rooms in the hotel that you can't go into. The honeymoon suite upstairs where his parents stayed, that's completely sealed off, locked behind an elevator. Don't go anywhere near it. Why? Well, the bellboy says that there's a witch up there. So obviously, you know, Adam Scott's character, Owen, he's saying, well, that's not real at all. It probably is. Like, there's an hour and a half on the clock here, so of course there is.
Yeah.
Of course this hotel is haunted. But without giving too much away, there's a chilling real-life mystery, something that doesn't involve ghosts or witches or anything at all, that piques Ohm's interest, and he kind of starts digging around in places that he shouldn't and questioning people that he shouldn't. And one thing leads to another, and you've got David Wilmot's a forest dweller. There's always a kooky forest dweller who kind of teams up with Ohm to solve this mystery, which I won't speak of. I think it is... Like, there is a real life mystery there, but it also is a ghost story. And I think every great ghost story, as far as I'm concerned, requires a pitch black sense of humor. I think you can take these things too seriously. McCarthy knows that. And so his film is as funny as it is freaky. And I think that's why they got Adam Scott, because he's obviously first and foremost a comedy actor, but he's shown from things like Severance as well that he can be good with suspense, he can be good with thrills. So he is just acing this assignment. Like, he's just a pro in every department. He's good with the one-liners. You genuinely believe that he's scared, and as a result, so are you. It's kind of a reasonably small budget, shot in Cork last year, but it's like Blair Witch. They're doing a lot with very little. The scares are real. It earns its jump scares. Like, this film, it did get me jumping a couple of times, which is more than I can say for something like, you know, The Mummy recently.
Yeah.
So that's an extra star straight away. Good supporting cast. Obviously it's indebted to Stephen King, but I'm okay with that. It does get itself a little bit too tangled up with a bit too much plot, but it's creepy, it's atmospheric, and you will not forget it in a hurry.
Sounds great. Out of five, just wondering.
I got four.
Four. I never asked you for Devil Wears Prada 2.
We'll go with a solid three. I know three, people hear that and they think, oh, it must be terrible, but three is, it's fine.
Yeah,
grand.
Very good. That sounds great. It sounds really scary, and it sounds like you'd be engaged from the beginning to the end. I've never seen anyone, Michelle, so excited about taking a taste of wine as you did during that. Your reaction was priceless.
I was doing a taste test just to make sure, guys.
We're moving on to a very special wine, are we?
We are. So we're going to have the red. If you want to have a little taste of this, what I love about it is how opulent and rich and deep it is. It is such a lovely glass of wine. So what we're trying is a wine from a producer. Do you guys like it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's got the wow factor, hasn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
That's really beautiful.
It is. And it's just, you can let it wash over you and just
the whole
hang
day,
out.
The character has just changed. Just feel more
so
myself.
This is produced by a winery called Poggio Altosoro, from a region called Bolgheri. And it's in Tuscany, and a thing started in the 70s where Chianti was so bad, and it was all about production and sales and not about quality at all. And do you remember when you went to an Italian restaurant that would have had a straw bottle and a candle in it?
Yeah.
So they're the old Chianti bottles that gave Chianti a bad name. And the best part about those bottles is that their actual name is a fiasco. Fiasco.
Really?
Yeah.
Would you like a fiasco?
Would you like a fiasco? Oh, sì, assolutamente. So, a lot of producers who were making really high quality wines in Tuscany and in the Chianti region didn't want to be associated with the fiasco. So they start producing wines right on the Tuscan coast. It's a stunning place, by the way. Happened to have also been there, which I forgot, and then I remembered when I looked back at my photos. Anyway, what does 6 years do? And so Bolgheri is this, it's kind of like the Prada of Tuscany. It's stunning. And the wines that were produced there, so they were actually the best quality wines coming out of Italy. But because they were outside of the laws, they were classed as the worst quality wines coming out of Italy. But the price tags were huge. And there was a mixture of wines. Some of them were made exclusively from Sangiovese, which is the Chianti grape. And then a huge range of them were made from Bordeaux grapes. So you're thinking of Cabernet Merlot, Cabernet Franc blends. What we're trying is actually, so although it's from Tuscany, It is, it's a Bordeaux blend. So it's a Merlot Cabernet blend. And you can taste that dark cassisy flavour in it. And it's really, really rich. So Bulgari is the region to look out for what I feel like are Bordeaux style wines that outperform Bordeaux at that price point. They're wow. very, very good. And so that's what a Super Tuscan is. In 1994, is it 90? Yeah. The Bulgari region got its own official classification, as opposed to being outside of the rules. It's now in the rules. And when you see Bulgari written on a label, you know it's going to be very good. And the wine that I have beside me, actually, the other one, is from Sassicaia. And Sassicaia, if anyone's familiar with it, costs hundreds and hundreds of euros. You couldn't buy it if you tried. It's on strict allocation. And they make wines from juice that isn't considered good enough to go into the flagship wine. They put it into a second and a third bottle, and this is the Guido Alberto. So if you wanted to try a Super Tuscan without the Super Tuscan price tag.
Sensational. Absolutely one of the nicest wines I've tasted in ages. Really gorgeous. Yeah. Did you have a go at that?
That was lovely.
Yeah, really nice.
It's the real deal.
Gonna have another go.
We've gone from really nice to that was lovely, you know, there's no end to the massive praise.
Thank you.
Yeah, we loved that. Listen, very on the money of things that are happening at the moment, Val Kilmer's appearance posthumously, an AI appearance.
Yeah.
Have you seen this, by the way?
No.
Heard about it.
Obviously, Val Kilmer passed away last year after a diagnosis of throat cancer. He's due to appear in this upcoming indie film called As Deep as the Grave, and it's been kind of marred by this controversy around, like, they were able to finish the film, as you said, through generative AI, which is something that he signed off on, like his estate and, you know, his family have been cooperating on it. His daughter has kind of come out with a statement now, Mercedes Kilmer, to say, you know, it started off as a way to overcome the limitations of his illness, then evolved into something that he was really like, oh, wait, I have a chance to actually set a precedent, and said that basically now people are falling into kind of two camps that, you know, like, if you're in a position like this, I suppose their argument is, like, at least they know it's being used in this way, in a way that he would have wanted, in a film that he was working on specifically, as opposed to someone with more nefarious means taking his image and his likeness and making something demented or something that he'd never signed off on. But I suppose, like, it's such a specific case then as well, though, that it is just, and it's obviously unfortunate due to his passing.
Yeah,
I suppose it's just not going to be the case for, I have, yeah.
What did you think?
Strange, I thought.
Did you for a second think it wasn't him?
No, but it's hard when you know that it's not. Hey, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, we already kind of know too much in that kind of sense.
I don't think you'd know, because I also knew, because I read about it. So I was looking at it in a way I would never normally look at an actor on screen, trying to see if I could see something, and you can't see anything.
Okay.
So that is, what does that say about the future?
Mm.
And for
it's getting more and more. Like, I've seen it in other examples, not necessarily with the people or whatever, but like with pictures and stuff, where it's just like the similarities are, or the differences are so minute now that it's kind of like, I would find it really difficult
to
tell the difference.
And this is only improving.
Yeah,
you know, and getting faster and faster. So what's interesting there too is it is his estate essentially taking control of his AI image.
Yeah,
for future projects.
Yeah, and then but then I'm like, what are we doing in the future then? You know what I mean? What I didn't realize as well is in the Top Gun sequel that they'd actually used an AI company to recreate his voice, because obviously he speaks as Iceman in the film. I didn't realize that was an AI company. It's just like they're in a really difficult position because whatever, he wanted to finish this film, as I said, very tragic loss. But like, I just worried that this is such a specific case and we're talking about it in such a way that we're kind of going to be applying it to everyone, and it's like maybe it shouldn't apply to everyone.
Well, you're going to see more and more of it, whether you want it or not. Very quickly before we go, a reboot of The Apprentice.
I thought we could end on good news, but we can't.
Donald Trump Jr.
is going to be taking over The Apprentice in the US. They're bringing it back, apparently. Amazon in very initial talks, and Trump said, you know what he said about his son.
Amazon are involved. I wouldn't have expected
Amazon. Crazy. Of all the streamers in all the world, Jeff Bezos had to walk into theirs. Crazy.
Mad.
Crazy.
Oh, well, what a world we live in. Thank you all very much for that indeed. That was fantastic. Michelle, Fionnuala and Chris.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.